Good morning. Call the meeting to order and welcome everyone. We're commenting it's a pretty dressed up crowd today. We're wondering what's maybe going on out there, but would acknowledge Commissioner Bob Levy on the telephone. Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jim.
Okay. And also, Kristen Leonard is sitting in for Curtis Robinhold today as executive director pro tem. She said it's just for one day. So glad to have Kristen aboard for that purpose. And I would call for a motion and second to grant a leave of absence to Commissioner Young, who is on jury duty.
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
That motion carries. Thank you. That reminds me, Commissioner Levy, if we get ahead here and you're trying to say something, we'll try and pause every once in a while so you get a chance to speak. I would call for motion and second for approval of the minutes of the regular commission meeting of September 13th, 2017.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion carries. Thank you. I would also say, just because I've had this experience and I think my problem's just been solved, but for all the commissioners who are getting their online materials, if you have an issue, see Elise or Pam after the meeting to make sure you can get logged in, which I haven't been able to do regularly, but I figure that may be my own technology challenge. And so Kristen, the executive director's report.
Hey. Thank you, President Carter, and good morning to the commissioners. I want to first call everyone's attention. I think we have our safety champions that are scrolling on the screens, which is always the perfect kind of introduction for Stan and his safety presentation.
Great, thanks. This month, the port will be participating in the International Shakeout Day on October 19th. And the International Shakeout Day occurs every third Thursday of October, and it's kind of a day of individual and community events that feature the largest earthquake drill ever. And it's organized kind of to inspire us to get ready for big earthquakes and to hopefully prevent disasters from becoming catastrophes. And in an earthquake, you may only have just a few seconds to protect yourself before you're either knocked down by large shaking or something falls on you. And so last month, I talked about planning and getting prepared for natural disasters like earthquakes. So I thought this month, and in conjunction with the Shakeout Day, I would talk about surviving an earthquake and recovering from an earthquake. And so surviving, whenever you feel shaking, always drop, cover, and hold on immediately. And drop where you are and onto both your hands and your knees. And this position will protect you from getting knocked down, and it helps you to stay low and hopefully, if there's a shelter nearby, to crawl to it. And then cover your head and neck with one arm and your hands. And if a sturdy table or desk is nearby, crawl underneath it for shelter. And if no shelter is nearby, then you want to crawl to an interior wall and stay away from any windows. And then stay on your knees and bend over and protect your vital organs. And then hold on until the shaking stops. And if you are underneath the shelter, it's best to grab a hold of it because it may shift during the shaking, and you want to be able to move with your shelter as it shifts around. And then if you have no shelter, continue to hold on with both your arms and hands over your head and bend over and protect your vital organs. And then after the shaking stops, you want to recover. And the best thing to do is immediately check on your family, friends, and any coworkers to see if anyone has any injuries. And then check your water, gas, and electric lines for damage. Turn off valves if you do have damage. And if you smell gas, immediately open your windows and your doors and get out of the where you are, and if you're able to, report that gas leak to the appropriate authorities. And then avoid downed electrical lines outside. Turn on your radio, or maybe if your house is fine, turn on your TV and get updates on damage, assistance, and any shelters that are open. And then stay out of damaged buildings. Grab your emergency gear and try and find shelter, or make your own shelter. And then remember, if the big one happens in any earthquake, there's always aftershocks. So remain prepared, and be diligent. And then one last thought that I did have is that, you know, with the great shakeout day coming on the 19th, it's, you know, a lot of businesses like the port will be participating in the event. Our children, most likely their schools, are going to be participating in the event. But it's also a great day to do something with your family and to inform each other or keep each other informed on what you can do during an earthquake to be safe and maybe even have your own family practice drill. That's it, Kristen. Oh, and I would say if you are interested in more information, there is a website, www.shakeout.org, that has a lot of resources concerning the event and what to do during an earthquake.
So we can all get our preparation kits ready. There was reference to Curtis being away for a trade mission that's happening right now in Asia. The governor is leading a group, and we are proud that, you know, there are several port leaders that are joining the group to promote Oregon products and business connections in Hong Kong and Tokyo. The delegation includes 12 manufacturers from Oregon, mostly in the food and beverage industry, and more than 50 public and private sector leaders are traveling right now. Interestingly, for the port, the trip also includes meetings with several of our partners to date, including Cathay Pacific, Subaru, Delta Airlines, and Ajinomoto Company. So that's where they are right now, and it'll be fun next month to get kind of a report out on how that went. The wildlife program, we had the privilege of, at last month's commission meeting, having Nick Atwell come and talk to us. And no good deed goes unpunished, Commissioner. We thought we would share a picture of you coming and getting a tour with Nick and his team of the wildlife program, but also to share some really good news. You won't be surprised that Nick and his team were awarded the FAA Sandy Wright Richard Dolbear Excellence in Strike Reporting Award for this year. This award is a recognition of the science and data behind our wildlife policies and practices. So great call out nationally for our team, and a fun opportunity, and I hope others will take the opportunity to come to the tour if you would like. In other accolades, Airports Council International recently recognized PDX, Hillsborough, and Troutdale Airports for again achieving airport carbon accreditation, reducing emissions by making investments in heating and lighting efficiency and technologies, electric, hybrid, or gas-powered vehicles, incentivizing public transportation, reducing corporate travel, and working with partners to encourage additional emissions reductions. So that was very exciting to be part of. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Lower Columbia River Channel Maintenance Planning begins public scoping meetings in October. The port is proud to support this effort to plan for future dredge material placement sites. Port employees will also be joining a Friends of Trees event in tree planting on November 4th with Sandy River Basin Watershed Council. Folks, and it's always a great opportunity. Often you have to put your raincoat and your rubber boots on as you're out there tree planting, but it's just a neat opportunity for port employees to really send the message about revitalizing the trees and the forest canopy in our neighborhoods as it impacts the work of the port. As in Hillsborough, the Hillsborough Airport Air Quality Noise Public Information Meeting is on October 12th. There's also some other action in Hillsborough. The 17th annual Hillsborough Air Fair is October 21st. This is a great opportunity to open our doors to families and the community at HIO, including kids' activities, tours, flight simulators, and conversations with our community partners. And finally, as a follow-up to Nick, we added that at the end and realized we were covering it twice. So that is the extent of our executive director's report.
Thank you for that. Is there a motion and second to approve the executive director's report? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That carries. Thanks, Dan, for that reminder. You're always good at that stuff. I hope we never have to use any of it. I don't have a sign-up sheet, but if there's anyone in the public that would like to make a statement to us at this point, this is the time to do it. So it appears not. Would any commissioner like a presentation of the two consent items?
I don't.
Okay. So I need a motion and second to approve those.
You need to read.
The first is the City of Portland Enterprise Zone Boundary Amendments. And the second is the Commission Policy Number 6.1.2 on Investments. And both of those are in your materials. So is there a motion and second to approve those two items?
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Those motions carry. Vince, you've got the first agenda item.
So good morning. As you know, we have been reviewing about 75% of the concessions here at the airport. We've gone through all three phases. As part of each of those leases, though, we committed to improving all of the storefronts for those projects and doing some other utility work. We've done the first two phases that were aligned with the first two phases of the concessions program. Since we approved the last one a month or so ago, we're now here for the final contract related to storefronts. We're also doing some utility metering, and also we're required to separate fats, oils, and greases from all of the other water and utilities. So we have a separate project for that. And so Dan is here to give you the information about this award.
Good morning. Thanks, Vince. Hey. We're here to request approval to award a public improvement contract to Todd Hess Building Company Incorporated in the amount of $2,138,495. That's for the completion of storefront improvements, like Vince said, at the Concourse D and Concourse C West node. Over the course of the last, this will be the fourth year, we've been redeveloping storefronts, providing utilities, and grease separation at all of the locations shown on the map there. It's been a long process, but we're finally getting through with it this year, and I think we've provided great amenities for our new concessionaires as well as those that have remained in place. They've got a new refreshed look in all the locations. This is what the storefront improvements will look like in the Concourse D node. We have updated the columns, provided new signage and glazing above, and some public seating amenities that we think will really create a new inviting place for concessionaires and customers to enjoy the concessions there. Schedule here shows really just what we've been doing over the last couple of years. We completed what we called phase three, which was actually phase two. We combined the first two phases, completed construction last year, or early this year. We have one remaining accumulator to install for the Laurelwood and Hopworks location that was just awarded in August. We've been working on the preliminary design for, and the final design for this latest round. What's interesting, we went to bid with this project the end of July, and at the initial pre-bid meeting, we had very limited turnout by the construction community. So we, after a lot of discussion with the trades, extended the bid twice to essentially a two-month bid period. At the end of that, we still only received one bid. It was responsive. But it just demonstrates how busy the market is and how it's difficult to get as much interest for these post-security locations in terms of getting all the trades to propose, because it's kind of a challenge meeting all the security requirements. We had a goal for small business participation of 13%. We anticipate achieving 14% with this contract. Just as a note, last year we had an 8% goal. We, in my opinion, knocked it out of the park with 17% participation. So the program's been tracking really well. What's shown here on the project budget and funding, storefront improvements are shown at $2.1 million. We have a remaining contingency of about 20% for the remaining work. We've been kind of tracking this over the last 3.5-4 years. So this is what we have left to spend in the program. And staff requests approval of the executive director's recommendation.
So questions or comments?
One question, and it's more just an information point. The lack of multiple bids, is that something you think you're going to run into with other projects going forward? I mean,
I really think it is. It's a challenge. And this is a relatively small contract. It is in a difficult location post-security. If we were, there is so much work out there. If we were building in a standard location on the street, it'd be a lot easier for the subs to get in and out. This location, even after three pre-bid walkthroughs, the subs were commenting, wow, it's really difficult to get back here unless you're badged already. And so that limits the pool to those that already either have badges or have worked at the airport in the past. We did a lot of outreach to try to drum up interest after the initial meeting, and it's just been a challenge getting them. They are focused on some of the larger projects we have, like terminal balancing or the Packer. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of diluting the pool, if you will. But we're still doing outreach as much as we can to get as much interest as possible.
Okay, thank you.
So I just looking at the airport or the concourses at this point, what you've already done, the stuff looks great. I mean, you've really done a nice job, and congratulations on that. The second thing before we vote here is, you know, we always want to know on the participation of minority-owned businesses. You've done a good job, particularly with this one. It's a long haul, and keeping your enthusiasm up, we really appreciate what you're doing. When you fall short, obviously, it's easy to be critical, but when you do better, I think it's worth acknowledging. So congratulations on that as well.
Thank you.
So is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
So move.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Thank you. Here. Vince?
So I'm going to do a little bit more of an introduction on this one. This is one of the larger projects that we've got going on, and so we want to give more context to this project. What you have in front of you is a request for an amendment to the J.E. Dunn contract to do some early work, but it's just getting started on this, and so I really wanted to give you all a little bit more context about this project. So this is the Parking Additions in Conrack project, as we call it here, the Packer project. It's one of the big five projects related under the program of PDX Next that are all in various stages of design and or construction. The terminal balancing project, we're about 95% design. That's moving forward well. The QTA right out the window is going to open this January. So the Packer project, and then the big ones, obviously the terminal core and the concourse A and B, and we're about 10% design on those, and hope to get to a recommendation for the airlines here later this in the next couple of months or so. But the Packer project, we're doing a design build on. We're at 30%, but in order to really move this project forward, we really have to clear the site and create some opportunities to get in. It's a very complicated site. I wanted to give just a little bit more context about this project. When we started on this, there are guiding principles that we established because it impacts a number of different modes of transportation here. It's parking, it's rental cars, and really it's going to impact the transportation network companies like Lyft and Uber as well. It's really a system of getting folks here. It's all about, for us, certainly the customer experience, and we have desired to keep the rental cars as close to the building as possible. We also want to provide close-in parking for the passengers here. It's a very efficient airport, and it's some of that is the layout. But there's also environmental benefits to keeping those folks here. We're not running shuttle buses all along Airport Way and having all the rental cars remotely. So we've been working with the rental cars on this and project, and obviously with our own internal staff on the parking side. We had a guiding principle that we wanted to keep as much of the rental car business on airport as possible. And you'll find at some airports, some of them are here and some of them you're riding a bus or a train or a shuttle or something like that. We wanted to get as much as we can here. The rental car market is continuing to grow, and we certainly are watching the transportation network companies. But the rental cars, and we're currently negotiating our agreement with them. If they could, they would tie up this facility for 30 years. They would take a 30-year lease. They believe that they are going to be in this business one way or another, whether it's going to be a traditional rental car or some other form, there's going to be a car, and they would like to have that. We still want to accommodate that demand. We're negotiating with the rental cars right now. We're not willing to go to a 30-year lease because we think the industry is going to change, and we're trying to create as much flexibility in this project to allow for differentiation between parking, rental cars, and the transportation network companies. And obviously, the other guiding principle here is parking. And we're trying to keep as much close-in parking as possible. We expect to have 23 million annual passengers here out in 2025. And so we're trying to keep as much of that in here as we can. We're out of that parking today. Certainly we're at the time of the year now. The second garage was closed today. That's going to happen from now until probably March. During the middle of the week, the second parking garage. And so we're limited as to the revenue that we can generate in the parking system today because of just capacity. There's just only so much space that you can have. And then finally, the other guiding principle, again, was flexibility. We know that those facilities will be needed. The question is, how will they be needed? And so we're creating ramping systems and structures and physical elements that will allow us to modify it over time as we needed to. So those were the guiding principles behind this project. Now the question is, how do you pay for this? It's a relatively large project, one of the bigger ones that we've done. And right now the rental cars, the way it's structured, is going to pay for about 57% of it, and the parking's about 43% of the use of this. And so when you look at the rental cars, we negotiate agreements with the rental cars. We're in the process of doing that right now. We plan on bringing those to you probably next spring. Rental cars pay us 10% of their gross revenues. They also pay for rent for their facilities. And as you can see, the revenues that we're generating, $24, $25 million a year in revenue from them. And we're trying to make sure that that's appropriate given the size of the footprint that they have and the kind of business that they're generating. And so we'll have that contract to you again sometime this spring. We also have a customer facility charge that was enacted in January of 2014. This is a newer kind of a facility charge modeled after the passenger facility charge that started in 2001. It's common amongst other airports. Whenever you rent a car at an airport that has one of these, there is a facility charge. Ours is $6 a day for a maximum of 4 days. And you can see the revenues that we have been generating, and right now we're using those revenues to, on a pay-as-you-go basis, to help fund some of the construction of the QTA right now. But there will be funding from this source going forward. We will leverage these revenues, and we will issue some bonds to pay for the rental car portion of the Packer project. So the rate setting, we have not changed the rate. That $6 for 4 days since it was put into place, and we'd like to keep that as long as we can. The rate setting is set by the executive director. We generally do talk about parking rates, rental car rates, and such with you all. And to me, we will be doing a full-blown rate study because understanding parking rates, impact rental car rates, impact the transportation network companies as well. So you could be moving shifts or shifting modes around. So we want to make sure we're looking at all of those rates holistically. But these revenues will be used to help pay for the project as well. Looking at the rental car program, today we have about 80% of the rental cars on site. And when we did a study back in 2014 to scope this project, trying to determine how big should the facility be. And at the time, we were looking at about a 30,000 square foot customer service lobby and the need for 2,000 ready return stalls. And you can see what we have today. We've got about 12,500 in the current lobby, which is undersized, and we have 1,259 stalls. One of the first things we did when we got JE Dunn on board was to really validate those assumptions about the size of the facility. And because, again, the study that we had originally done was about 3 years old, and just seeing what's been happening with the market. And based on what we've come back with, we felt the need to have this facility be a little bit larger than what we had anticipated. J.E. Dunn and their consultant thought we needed 45,000. We're not going to do that. We think we can get away with 30,000 square foot, because as we've seen on the airline side, technology, most people don't need to go to the counters, right? I think at some point you'll just head straight to the car. And so we don't know that there'll be as big a need. So we're going to keep that at 30, but we are adding more ready return stalls to have capacity out into the future. So that drove a little bit of the cost differential in this project, because it's a little bit bigger than what we'd anticipated. Looking at the parking side of the business, today we have about 17,000 spaces, which includes the employees, and you can see the revenues that we're generating in parking, up to $65, $67 million. And certainly that's a big number. Parking's a good business to be in. But as I will frequently say here, parking has a lot of mouths to feed. And so the parking revenues and the rental car revenues are part of the Port Cost Center. But the Port Cost Center has other facilities and operations that don't generate revenue or are net losers of revenue. So Airport Way, and we'll be doing an 82nd Avenue interchange project here in the next few years. That is funded out of parking and rental car revenues. The General Aviation Airport System, and we've brought to you several the master plans of both Troutdale and Hillsborough that show some substantial capital improvements at there. Those airports don't have the revenues to cover those, so we take revenue from the Port Cost Center to help fund capital at the GA airports. And then it's certainly paying its other share of other PDX costs, such as aircraft maintenance facilities, the military lease, and the obligations over there. We just got some land back and facilities that need to be redeveloped over there. That all comes out of the Port Cost Center. So, yes, parking does generate revenue, but it's used in a number of different ways. And we also share a good portion of this revenue with the airlines. So they get about anywhere between $6 to $10 million a year to help lower their costs. That's part of the airline agreement as well. So lots of uses for public parking, but it's, again, another funding source for this project also. When we look at parking, as you've seen it today, again, we're out certainly in the second garage. And what this is showing is our capacity and where we're at today and just these relatively low growth scenarios of projections. And there are times of the year we're just out of space. And depending on which product it is, at the holidays, we'll do a little better here close in. But the economy lot, we will be out of space, and we get to what we know as creative parking. And trying to identify additional spaces. We've used the surface lot where the Packer project will go for overflow parking, but now those spaces will be taken away as we get into that project. And then we've used some gravel lots out towards the economy facilities to try to accommodate all of the parking here. So we're running out of parking, and we will run out relatively quickly here. And the issue for us is, these projects take a long time from idea to plan to design to approval and construction. And so we're trying to deal with the capacity going forward and not run out in time. So that's what we're trying to line up here, that we'll bring on new facilities when we need that capacity. Just a couple more for me. This was the original plan of what this building would look like. This was back in 2014 and a project that when we originally asked for the exemption from competitive bidding, this is what we thought the project would look like. It was going to be a seven level structure. The way those dark lines are, it's sort of contoured backwards. There's less space on the seventh floor than there is on the sixth versus the fifth and the fourth, and that's because of the slopes away from the runway and what we can, what's allowed to be built in there. So the higher you go, the less space there is. And you'll see in the new design of what that looks like, it's been changed a little bit. I'd call out just a couple of things here that we've done differently. The original plan for this project had the CSB that this facility right here. Oops, sorry, I'm gonna go backwards. Yeah. Can you get me backwards, Steve? Sorry.
A little bit back, a couple deals there.
Can you get me back a couple?
There,
that's good. So the CSB, this is the customer service building. The original plan for this project had the customer service building actually in the facility here. And we made the decision that we felt like it would be better to have it over here. It's closer to the terminal building, so the customers would only have as far to go. It also preserves more space within this project for what we felt was the most pressing need, which would be parking and or rental car spaces. So we've created some internal ramping systems that will allow flexibility in the use of this building over time. But it also, again, gets the customers away and over to out of the garage itself. So they're closer, and that we think that's a better customer service part of the program. Also, we have moved the toll plaza, and currently it is south of the garage today. We will permanently move it up here, and we felt like this was the best alternative of moving this. This is getting congested here already. We know we needed a little more capacity, so we decided to move the toll plaza up here, and this allows more flexibility here. What that does is it eliminates this return to the terminal. So currently, if folks need to circle, they do it right here. This project will eliminate that. So what we will do will be out on 82nd, we will have a return to terminal out there. You'll do a U-turn at the intersection of 82nd and Airport Way. There is enough room out there, and that's part of what this project will do as well. Down here, this is where the light rail line runs, and we're working with TriMet about the potential of double tracking. Here right now, there's only one track that comes in, and so they have to sit and hold a train out for the other one to leave before they can get the other one in certain times of the day. When TriMet sets their schedule, it starts with the red line because of these operational impacts to them. So we drive a lot of schedule issues with TriMet. So at some point, we would like to double track this, and there's just not a lot of room here. So that's another reason why we moved the toll plaza up there. So there have been just a number of different changes from when we originally started on this project in 2014 until where we are today. This is just a schematic of what the project will look like. You have the QTA, the fuel wash area that's being constructed right here. This will be the new packer, and you can see how the tiering effect goes. And then this is some employee parking here. And then this will be the toll plaza on the exiting. So this is what it will look like when it's all said and done. This is another view again. This will now only be a six level structure instead of seven. By the time you looked at a seventh structure, given the slopes, it would have been this narrow little strip, and we just didn't feel like it was worth the extra expense to get to that, given the limited amount of space that you would have added to it. Here's just some other renderings of what will happen. So ideally, the rental car customers will go down into the tunnels. So they'll do this on the south side, and then they'll go up. We'll create an opening here that will go south out of the tunnel, up stairs and escalators, and cross over into the new customer service building. And this was part of the project as well. So that's really where we're at on the project right now. The original budget on this, and Dave will talk a little bit more about it, was $246 million. We're at $268.2 right now. And again, the changes that we made, we believe, are around capacity and customer service. And at this point, we believe between the parking revenues that we've got, the customer's facility charges, and our bonding ability within the CFC, the customer facility charge, we do have the funding to be able to pay for this. So I'm going to stop there with kind of the overview of the project, and then Dave's going to talk about some of the enabling work, and there's eight different things that I think we need to do here before we even really get started in the footprint of the project.
So before we go to Dave, just one question to you, Vince, is that last statement, is there enough benefit from additional spaces and other convenience, I guess it would be viewed as revenue generating, to pay on a fairly short run the additional costs that we're now being asked to support?
Yes, over the long run. So when we look at our forecasts of our collections for CFCs, the parking revenues, and just to be clear, are you asking about the $84 million that we're asking for today, or just in over the full of the increase of the project?
Of course, the entirety of the project going from 240, whatever,
246 to 268.
Right.
Yes. So as we've modeled it based on our forecasts of revenues that will be coming in, we do have enough to meet all of our bond covenants and collect all the revenues and create everything we need to do. Now, if something goes south and we're not collecting as much, we do have alternatives. We can increase parking rates. We can increase this customer facility charge. Right? We can do those things. There is also potential that, depending on the timing, we may be able to reduce scope in the project as well. That obviously gets more complicated from a design perspective. We would prefer not to do that. But we do have a list of different alternatives and levers that we can pull should something go the wrong direction and the revenues don't materialize.
Right. Thanks.
Well, thanks for that long lead in there. That was outstanding, Vince. And I think it was at least on par with Stan's item. So I want you to know that. So today I'm here to request approval of roughly $84 million. And we're calling it the enabling scope. And this is a general picture of that scope on the screen now. But before I get into talking about the elements there, I would like to introduce our primary player from J.E. Dunn, Darren Stegenmuller. He's the Northwest regional leader. He's vice president, and he's going to lead the designers and the constructors on this project. You can stand up or wave there, Darren.
Yeah,
this is the first large-scale design build that the port's undertaken, and Darren, along with the stakeholders and the port's project management team, are going to assure that this is a quality delivery that's done in accordance with all of the defining principles and goals that we established early on. So we're going to team up and collaborate and make this thing happen. So getting on with the enabling scope here, as Vince led into here, the number one item on the screen is to get the 82nd U-turn, the airport way U-turn at 82nd established, and also a kind of an overhaul of the staging area, which is north of the employee lot. Those items will sequentially happen very early on, and the items are numbered kind of as they will proceed. Again, this is kind of an orchestrated dance that we have to perform to keep all the operations unimpeded and uninterrupted, and to clear the site of all of its current constraints so that we can build the Packer structure, which is outlined in a dotted line on this map. The second one is the toll plaza and a pedestrian tunnel that we are connecting to the middle of Packer. That's an underground structure that connects the south tunnel to the middle of Packer. The three item on there is a modifications to the active south helix, which now currently most of the garage parking exits through the helix. And so we're going to be modifying that as it remains in service. Item number four up there is we're connecting that helix to the toll plaza, and we will relocate the jockey road, which all of the rental car movements between the QTA and P1 and P2 will happen going through the site initially, and then we'll relocate them to the south and the west. And the number five item there is the removal of the existing ramps that come out of the parking garage, both for jockeys and for the public. And we will be recirculating traffic around the central utility plant. Hopefully we'll be opening that up a little bit better than it is today. It's highly constrained. So there's just a lot of complexities and intricacies and sequencing of this work. It's almost gonna, it added almost a year to our project to get these things done very methodically. So our schedule also has somewhat extended. Oh, sorry, wrong way. So, and in addition to this enabling contract amendment that we are requesting today, we'll add a pre-procurement of the steel purchase for the main packer structure to the tune of $10.6 million. Really being proactive, trying not to get caught up in all of the active construction. We're going to pre-place the order and design the steel, pre-place, buy so many tons at the mill early on so that we don't experience delays. It's a risk reduction mechanism, highly applicable in this current environment that we're in. Oh, man, I keep backing. Let's go one more. And as Vince alluded to also, you know, we have experienced some budget increases. I think they're all these budget increases are value added to a large extent to better serve the rental car industry and to better serve the public using this facility. The contract of $4.195 million was the initial contract to J.E. Dunn presented in January 2017. Today's enabling work amendment at 84, it's just a little over $84.145 million, will not only complete the final design, procure the $10.6 million worth of pre-order the steel for Packer, but it will also do all those enabling elements that I were on my first diagram that I was speaking on. And then in June of next year, we will come back to you, the commission, for a final DB services amendment, which will wrap up the entire GMP at roughly the $217 million number. And then we will work for another 2 years and be chasing this thing towards completion. There's early work not in the J.E. Dunn contract, which is part of this budget of $8.198 million. An example of that was Chris Edwards' Taxiway B amendments that relocated Pacific Power and Light primary feeders to the terminal that needed to be moved. They were located out on the airfield, and her contract took that over and accomplished that, but it was charged to this particular budget. We have reduced the port staff and contracted services from about $1 million. Some of those services are basically the special inspection services that we normally perform. Those are going to be performed by J.E. Dunn's team. And the port contingency was reduced some of to $34 million. Some of that contingency is allocated to the Dunn contract. Understanding where they are with their risk position at this point in time in history at 30% design. So some of the $84 million has a little bit of contingency, plus we know quite a bit more about the project now than we did 6-7 months ago, a whole lot more, I'll say, and we feel like the risk position can be reduced substantially in that regard. So we came up with a total budget of $268.2 million or a $22.2 million increase over the original funded budget. And as far as the funding sources are from the Port Cost Center, I think we have set a target of 12% small business design. We are tracking at 15% now on the design side of things, and our small business goal for the construction side of the equation here is 15%. Of course, we haven't started constructing anything, but we will be aggressively pursuing those opportunities as they arise. So I think we're so far we've been able to create some nice design opportunities for small business. And just a kind of an accounting of and Vince went through this. We don't need to go through the, I don't think, the whole addition up to $22 million. But the new structure, even though it is only six floors, is as opposed to seven, is 100,000 additional square feet. We've made it wider, and the external CSB, customer service building, was certainly an improvement in a lot of respects, and we'll add $7 million. Anyway, it goes down to a lot of items. And then I show the contingency and port cost reductions at the bottom. So we can revisit those if you have questions about those. I did mention earlier that our schedule has extended. I believe I was here in January talking and mentioning that we felt we could get this done in Q2 of 2020. And the Dunn team, along with all their designers, have enlightened me on what it really takes to do this project in accordance with all of our needs. And we are now at the end of quarter one in 2021. So that's all been communicated to our stakeholders and our team also. So you don't know. So with that, staff would like to request approval of the executive director's recommendation to award a contract amendment to J.E. Dunn Construction Company for just over $84 million.
Questions?
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
One, I noticed, given all of the enabling work, and particularly now with the longer timeline, wondering if you're expecting that the construction will impact the current parking operation and therefore the revenue that's coming out of current parking that we're using to pay for this. Do you have a sense of that?
I don't think so. Sorry. The only difference here is that we were using some of that area for overflow parking. And so we're going to have to get even more creative on the parking. But we're not taking any of the parking operations out of operation. So we'll certainly have to deal with, just normal construction impacts. But we don't anticipate an impact on the parking revenues. So we'll just get more creative with those overflow spaces that we've had to deal with. And those are pretty limited duration.
Okay, thank you. My second question is just about the budget. You mentioned there were a couple of items that are in this budget, but were separate contracts. Just want to make sure there isn't anything you foresee at the moment that will also, that's sort of outside but might impact this budget.
No, I don't believe so. I think when we learned that Packer was coming online, we really had to format and scramble to get mostly the Pacific Power and Light feeders moved out. I think we have a good understanding of the site now. We've done quite a bit of potholing to uncover some of those unknowns. So I believe we're on track to not have any more surprises in that regard.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Levy, are you still there and have any questions?
I don't have any questions.
Okay.
I had a couple of questions, mostly first I have a comment. I want to praise the port for keeping the rental car on site and the close-in parking. That is a luxury. I travel through many airports, and I'm always so relieved to have on-site parking. I am curious about when you talk about you're taking into account the technology needs of the future, how far you've gone in that thinking in terms of the design, because I think not only the way we're acquiring our transportation is changing, but also the actual cars themselves all the way through. Are we thinking about the autonomous car and enabling this structure? Certainly, it's probably impossible to design a structure at this point to accommodate that, but enabling the structure so that when the time comes, it is a much easier retrofit or adaption.
Well, you want to talk about some of the changes we made in the structure and the design?
Yeah, we are designing in a lot of flexibility here. When it comes to the autonomous car, that's sort of a wild card, and maybe Vince might want to address that later. But we are locating and being able to go from three to floor, transform businesses, both rental / parking between floors, providing flexibility for that maneuver. That provides us, I think, some financing flexibilities also. We are also, if for some reason the parking demands shrunk over time instead of growing, we've got the ability to reclaim space within the structure by having our demoing rapidly being able to demo a couple of bays on the south side to open up more space. Again, a flexibility item. We're going to provide some issues during design, mostly piling and column sizing, to be able to bring that back into alignment. Maybe I can point to a diagram here on the on this diagram. So if space is available here, we're going to have some ability to demo this from south to north and shrink the size should autos kind of come out of favor down the road too. So there is adaptability here. And I mentioned the ability to go from three to four to exchange both rental, maybe take rental cars from three, maybe up to four, or public parking from four down to three. Those adaptability features will also be in there. Trying to think of some other specific items that we designed in for flexibility regarding internal ramping also.
Yeah, I mean, there's the internal ramping. I guess the other thing that I would say is that we looked at this, that we're going to have parking structure one, P2, and the Packer project. We felt like that this amount of infrastructure was the right amount to take care of all of the needs. I would expect after the rental cars start and they move into the Packer project, that'll free up the first and second floors on the first parking garage and the first floor in the second parking garage. I will expect that in P1, we will use that space, and we're probably going to end up moving the transportation network companies into the first floor of the garage. Right now, there's just a tremendous amount of traffic that gets generated on that lower roadway. If you've ever had to come out here at night, at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and traffic is backing up, we're going to have to get those folks off of there. So trying to just create as much flexibility in all three of these facilities to adjust in the technology. I would also say if autonomous cars come along and maybe they park themselves, right, you restripe it and you can probably get more space in there because they don't need to open their doors. And so we'll do something like that. So we're trying to keep those things and not put, hard bollards in and such. So to create that. But it is hard to tell how long. When will this and what does it look like? So I think what we have is three sort of base buildings that we're going to try and figure out how to, and there's connectivity between all of them. So how do you create that over time and that flexibility? That's what we're going to try and have with this.
Okay. And we're in the design development phase now too. So we will not, stop looking for further opportunity to innovate and discover, these technologies.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see between now and your June review what you come up with in this particular area.
So I don't attend the airport task force meetings, but it seems to me that in this strategic look, and this is obviously part of that going forward, we have to balance public transportation versus our economic interest in parking. And traffic continues to stack up on the freeway serving the airport. Just want to make sure that the group that's thinking out 5 years or more continues to think about how we interface with TriMet. And that goes for the benefit to our employees as well.
Right.
Not to be forgotten when we have these big budget items for parking. So just a flag there going forward.
Yep. And we are, again, we're having conversations with them about two separate projects. One, the double tracking to get in there, which will help them operationally. And then the 82nd Avenue overpass.
Right.
And in an ideal world, the MAX line would change grade as well. That's a big project. That's a cost to them. It's certainly a benefit to us. So we're very well connected with TriMet and also on service levels.
Yep.
As we've talked about before, right, it's closed between midnight and 4. We have a lot of people that need to get here early in the morning. So we continue to work with them on trying to expand service, but it's a challenge for them because they take the whole system down. So it would only, that's just an operational issue for them. But we do talk to them about service levels as well.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Commissioner Cook.
Thank you very much. My questions are very layperson's questions. Excuse me, two questions. earlier, one of the slides that you showed, excuse me, in terms of a cost centers for the entire 22 million increase, and there was a line said the additional general conditions. What does that mean? What does it include?
Oh, that was my explanation on my budget.
You did not explain that, but I'm just curious.
General conditions are basically a broad category of costs which cover J.E. Dunn's presence on site with their, they're going to have 20 to plus staff members at various positions to manage, control, and execute this project. And the general conditions are describing their involvement.
Thank you. One more question. Another layperson, maybe the question goes to you. In terms of a futuristic thinking, you know, whether it's a technology or, you know, you earlier talked about a safety earthquake related. In terms of a potential earthquake situation, this particular structure that you're thinking of erecting, how would that be different from the structure that we have today?
Well, the codes evolve on a every other year basis, and they only become, the buildings only get stronger. And we've had extensive resilience discussions in-house on what the appropriate level of resilience for a parking garage would be. And it's hard to put it on a par with an office building or, a runway, which is an essential facility for the airport. But with the modern codes as they are, this building's not going anywhere, essentially.
Question, how is that different from the two structures we have today?
Well, today's, you're talking about the correct existing parking garages. They're built to the codes of the time, and this building will be stronger than those buildings.
You're looking for an incremental benefit,
yeah,
something specific.
Well,
if you can call one upgrade, if you can't, we can provide more information.
Basically, I think these buildings are designed to the code of their day, which is not a, they're meant to survive. They're meant to be a life safety level of service, if you will. So there will be some bit of damage after a severe earthquake, should that large scale earthquake occur. There will be repairs required. But the incremental, to go from a code to a immediately occupiable facility here for our Packer project was an $11 million add. Okay, so that's the incremental dollars you're talking about. So over a $200 million, you're adding a 10% or 5%, 5 to 10% adder premium for immediate occupancy realization outcome there.
Yesterday, during the task force meeting, we were told the city of Hillsborough, for example, established its own code relative to the earthquake. It was number 9 that I was told, right? That really gave me inclination to ask. So current code here is a 9, also 9?
We use site-specific, and one of those site-specific outcomes is a 9 subduction zone quake. It is considered as an occurrence here. The probabilistic, it's only a 1 in 2,500 year or so event, that one, but it is considered for our structures.
So this is over 9?
Yes, it'd be that same 9 on the coast and articulated through the ground to this location.
Thank you.
Did that really answer your question?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's an in-depth.
Yeah. I think it's a great question, and I think it's appropriate to continue getting more information on what it actually means when you say you build a code and codes change, because the kind of the critical piece is that, well, is it just safety to get out, or is it actually going to survive for use?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we've got the insurance question. So
those
can all be dealt with further going along. But any other questions of this particular request? Is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
I second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Commissioner Levy?
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. It was a great presentation. Lots of questions remain out there on this various things, but we'll get to them.
We continue to discuss the seismic resilient issues almost weekly here, so it's an internal discussion as well as a commission discussion too.
Right.
So,
okay. Thank you.
Nice work, Dave. Thank you.
Vince, you've had a big day here.
A couple more to go. Yeah. So this morning we're here to talk about an implementation contract on the McBride Slough. This is a drainage canal on the southeast side of the airfield, and a lot of the stormwater that happens, particularly out on the airford or on the airfield, drains into that. It really hasn't been dredged or maintained for quite a long time, and so it's time for us to get into that. Now, we're also under an order with DEQ to investigate and remove some legacy contamination that's in the sediment. These contaminants include pollutants such as PCBs and heavy metals and pesticides that have accumulated over the past 60 years. It's difficult to determine where these have come from, so we've been working with the airlines over the last, it's been probably 5 years or so here, to identify the specific sources. We've been negotiating with them and have come across, come up with a funding recommendation for them. So the airlines are funding 75% of this, and the Port Cost Center is funding 25% for us and our insurers. So we have a stormwater management program that's in place to prevent any additional contaminants from entering into the slough. And we've been working here for the past few years to address the solution, and we're now finally to the point where we're ready to implement the resolution through this contract. And I'll let Marcel go through the rest of the detail.
Great. Thanks, Vince, and good morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, I'm here to request your approval for the award of a negotiated contract for remedy implementation for cleanup of McBride Slough. As Vince mentioned, McBride Slough is a waterway on the southeast side of the airfield, shown on this slide here, and it drains about one-third of the airfield, making it by far the biggest contributor of stormwater to the slough. The drainage system, including McBride Slough, is maintained by Multnomah County Drainage District, MCDD. The project itself was initiated about 6 years ago when MCDD needed to dredge to address some flooding concerns. At that time, sampling was done of the sediments, which showed contamination was present. So the port subsequently worked with DEQ to address the next steps on dealing with that contamination. Subsequent process also included a 2012 consent order for the investigation phase of the work and a consent judgment which details the actual cleanup plan and approach. Then in June of this year, the port finalized and submitted the final design for the project. So in order to gain maximum benefits from early contractor involvement, the port issued a request for proposals prior to starting the design work. So per that request for proposal, the port would negotiate a contract for the implementation of the work if pre-implementation work under an initial contract would be successfully completed by the contractor. So Golden Enviro was selected under that RFP and has successfully completed the pre-implementation work. So we have now negotiated a contract for the implementation work with Golden Enviro, and that's what I'm here for, to ask your approval, your award. So the work of the contract is summarized on this slide. It consists of dredging, which is done in majority hydraulically by hydraulic pipeline dredge, and then pumping the water to a dewatering plant, which is set up on shore. At that place, the sediments are being dewatered, then loaded into trucks and trucked to a landfill. After the dredging, a layer of activated carbon mixed with sand or gravel will be placed on the area dredged to absorb or neutralize any remnant contaminants. So based on this scope of work, the small business goal was set at 5%. So this picture shows the main piece of equipment, which is a very small pipeline dredge. It basically sucks up the sediments in the front and pumps it through the hose in the back to the dewatering plant. Talking about dewatering plant, this is what that looks like. So that's going to be set up on shore. The slurry comes in on one end, is dewatered, water comes out on the other end, and on the side, the dewatered sediments come out to be loaded into trucks and trucked away. Dewatering the sediments makes it a lot easier to transport them and a lot easier and cheaper to dispose of them. So the technical work on the project started in 2012 with a remedial investigation. And as mentioned, an initial contract was awarded to Golden Enviro in 2015 after the feasibility study, but before the start of the design work. So upon your approval today, work for the implementation would take place next year between May and October. As far as the dollars, the contract amount of just over $3.5 million is part of a total project budget of just over $6.6 million. It's funded, like Vince already mentioned, 75% from the airline cost center, 25% from the port cost center, and the port seeks reimbursement from our insurance carriers for our 25%. And with that, asking for approval to award the contract to Golden Enviro for the McBride Slough cleanup.
Any questions?
Yeah. One quick question. What kind of contamination are you talking about? From the sediments, you know, from the general use of the airport. That's what the language says.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so over decades of stormwater getting into McBride from the airfields, it has built up in the sediments. Vince mentioned the contaminant groups. So it's PAHs, which is oil products, some PCBs, some pesticides, and some heavy metals.
Yeah. When you go back here decades ago, various airlines have had paint shops here, maintenance facilities, various parts in the airport over time that have been abandoned, and certainly rental car operations as well. There used to be a wrecking yard out here, out where PIC is. So there's just all kinds of historical operations that likely didn't have the same level of environmental protections that we do today. So
those contaminated sediments, once you know, dredged, where do they go? Get dumped?
They go to a landfill. So a basically solid waste landfill.
Do we know which one it'll go to?
Most likely Wasco County.
Okay. Yeah. Arlington up in Wasco County, perhaps?
So, okay to be dumped there. That's what it is.
Yes.
I had just a quick question along the same lines, and maybe I just missed it in your explanation, but is there additional testing that would be done during the project to see if in fact the sediments have the same contamination that is projected, and then what's the plan for additional testing after the project's completed?
Right. So, for disposal at the landfill, we have satisfied the testing requirements. We've done quite some testing of the sediment, so we know what's in there, and both the port and the EQ are satisfied with that level, and the landfills are too. So that can be used to justify the disposal at the landfill. We will do some testing after the dredging, but part of the remedy is to, after the dredging, place a 6-inch layer of activated carbon and sand. So that's going to cover any remnant contamination that will stay on site. And the activated carbon in that will bind and neutralize some of those contaminants. So because of that, the testing of what's left behind is not that relevant as it would otherwise be.
Then I guess a follow-up question on that is then, is that just part of the normal, it'll become part of port's normal maintenance to make sure that layer, it continues to be effective?
Yes, there is, as part of the plans with DEQ, we have a long-term monitoring plan and requirement, so it's for 20 years initially, which means every 5 years we will do testing and making sure that the remedy is holding up as expected and designed.
Thank you.
Just two questions. One, does this fall within the scope of the record of decision for Superfund at all? I mean, this is...
No, it's not
different
related.
Different asset, this in geography, correct. Separate and apart, okay. And then the second, I know that this is not something that has happened on a recurring basis. This is the initial effort in this part. I was looking at the small business target of 5%, and I understand this is very specialized, but do we have any sense as to whether that target is... will incent the contractor to really take whatever efforts they can have to support small business? I mean, I'm sure they do this work in other places. It would be interesting to see if that is kind of, you know, which end of the spectrum. Is it encouraging? Is it a low target? I think the port has done a great job in moving that participation rate across projects. It's just that it stands out at such a low target.
Right. Yeah, there's a few things to that. One is, first of all, Golden Enviro is a federally certified small disadvantaged business, but not with State of Oregon. And as far as the percentage, it's set the normal way, looking at what the scope of work is and seeing what's available. In this case, most of the work is the actual dredging, which is the one company, and then most of the subcontracted work is the disposal at the landfill, which is the larger companies. And then there's a few things in between, such as the trucking and some minor support services, and that's really where the opportunities are for small business participation beyond the main contractor. Yep.
And it's, I think, a follow-up to what the other commissioners asked, which is just, and I think you touched on it, Vince, this is historical contamination, and we're remedying historical contamination, monitoring that the remedy is appropriate. Do we have a sense of whether there's continuing sources of this contamination? In other words, will we have to remedy this again in a few years?
I believe that we feel like the stormwater management system that we've been working on, the stormwater master plan, has enough protection in it to prevent it. But again, we'll have to continue to monitor it for the next 20 years. So we think that we've done what we can and what we need to, but certainly there's no guarantees of it. And there have been a number of different things that have taken place with various other cleanups at those particular sites that we required contractors to do. So, for example, at the rental car, the current quick turnaround area, there was identified contamination there. The rental cars are on the hook for cleaning that up, and they have been doing that over time, and they're just about finished with that. So that, we believe, was probably part of what over time has penetrated into the stormwater and made it eventually south. So we've been doing those little projects kind of around the airport when we find out about them. And so we think that we're there, but certainly there's no guarantees, and we'll just continue to monitor it with the sampling.
Other questions? Is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? So that motion carries. Thank you for the information, and that's very helpful.
Okay, last one. So we're doing an amendment here, and just a first reading for our ordinance. I'm with Chris Neal. Chris is our Director of Public Safety and Security. This is his first commission presentation. I feel compelled to say that. Chris here is about... He wore his PDX carpet socks for the occasion today, so I think that's great. He's about his 1 year anniversary, like today.
17th.
But to us, this is a great item. It really is creating an opportunity for us here to improve the diversity of the hiring out at the Airport Fire Department. It's currently under the civil service program, and it's a fairly rigid program in how we have to do the hiring out there. And so when there is an opportunity for us to go out there and increase some underrepresented work groups, this amendment to the ordinance will create that for us. And so I'll let Chris go through the details about how the current process works and the changes that we're trying to make here and why we want to do this.
Right. Good morning. So I am the last one. So I pray not to be before you long, but those prayers are based on your questions at the end. So if we keep that in mind, I appreciate that too. I'm kidding. You can ask whatever you want, clearly.
But just Chris, for the record, having talked to you many times, I'm sure this is not going to be in it. Extreme effort for you to do the presentation in spite of Vince's concerns.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about how the process works today, very briefly. Then with this amendment, how it will work in the future. And then at the end, I'll do the recommendation and so forth, how it works. So let me go into the first slide. There's five parts, really, that I want to dive into that you should know about. Number one is the application part. Anytime that we put out a vacancy to be a firefighter, there's hundreds of people out there that want to be one of our heroes out there in the field. So we have hundreds of folks that come through in this application process that we have to vet. Now, the important thing to note, though, here is that this application process is probably the biggest hurdle that we have when it comes to our underrepresented individuals. Just applying, just knowing that they can be a firefighter, just knowing that they may have the skills and the abilities to be a firefighter anywhere is a hurdle that we have to get over. And it's a long-term thing that we're looking at, how to solve this problem. The second part is a written exam and test. This is scored like any other written exam test that you can imagine. And then third, I've also put an asterisk here because I want to talk a little context, is the resume evaluation and the scoring. So what that means is once you've done that, you've applied, you've taken the test, you get a high score, then we take a look at your resume. In your resume, then we assign points. So you get big points for things like already being a firefighter. You get points for being a volunteer firefighter. You get points for being in the military and having been a firefighter. You can see where I'm going with this. So because of what I've outlined in the application process, there really isn't a history of underrepresented folks that have this experience that gets you top points when we come to the resume evaluation and the scoring. So we already start off with a narrow pool of applicants. Then when you get to the third part of the process here, that pool gets even more narrow. So this list that's generated from the resume evaluation and scoring goes anywhere from 1 to 50, 60, regardless. It's based on how many vacancies we've got. Rarely do we find an underrepresented individual, female or minority, that gets anywhere near 15 or 20 on that list. It'll be a very proud day of mine that we hire 21 firefighters in one shot. I doubt that that will happen anytime soon. So the question is, how do we fix that? What do we do today to try to get there? The next part I want to talk about is the in-person interview process. So you've taken your written exam, you get a high score there. Then we do the resume evaluation and the scoring. You score high because you have a ton of experience. Then you get brought in, that list is then generated and you get brought in for an interview process. This process is very prescriptive, this interview process. It's not like normal where you would get a stack of resumes and then you look at who's fits the best and you pick whoever you want. It's prescriptive and therefore you have to go in order from one to however many people are on that list. Now, during this process, if someone comes in the interview and they don't work out, you can go to number 2, 3, 4, whatever. But you do have to go in order. And so that is a problem when you are an underrepresented person and you're not even on number, you're not even 20, 25, 30, and so on. So that's the third process. And then finally is the candidate selection. Here's what this amendment does differently. When you get to the resume evaluation and scoring, the fact that the underrepresented person may be and usually is much further down the list, what this amendment will do will find the highest scoring underrepresented person and bring them into the in-person interview process so at least that underrepresented person can see the door. It's not often that they even get to see the door in the process that we have right now. So this amendment is an addition to what we've already got. It doesn't take away from the three people that would have normally gotten to the process in the beginning. You have one vacancy, you bring in the top three. That's how it works today. Tomorrow, it will work one vacancy. You bring in the top three like you normally would. And then in addition to that, you'll bring in a fourth, which is the highest ranking underrepresented individual. Doesn't guarantee that they get the job, clearly. But it does guarantee that they at least get to see the door. They at least get to get an interview to see what the process is. And then from there, you'll make the candidate selection. I can go on to the next slide here. I've talked a little bit already about what it does. These are some nice bullets here. I think it's pretty clear why it would be a good thing. I do think it's important that we increase the underrepresented capability in the fire department. And I also think that it's important, we think that it's important that our fire department reflect the community that it serves and so on up here. So that in total is what this amendment's going to do. I can go to the next slide. This is our recommendation. This is the language today that says when you have a vacancy, you bring in three, yada. I've went through that already. This is the language that we want to add. And the thing that I'll note here in this is that we will bring this language in only when there's an identified discrepancy or deficiency in our diversity and equity. Newsflash, there is one today. So with your approval, we'll be moving forward on that. We have over 40 firefighters, three that are women, one that's in the academy, and no minorities. So I do think it's important. We think that it's important to go ahead and move on this as soon as we can. That, I think, is my presentation. This is the recommendation here. I can answer any questions necessary.
Questions?
Well, I just want to commend you. This is great news, and I love the vision that our firefighters will reflect the community they serve. I'm wondering if there can be some additional things, or maybe perhaps you've thought of these things. Is there a way to offer, like we do with the small businesses, some types of workshops for resume preparation, or is this part of the program, as well as the interview preparation? Are there things that can be done in those areas?
Right. Yes, and we have thought about some of that. Earlier, when I mentioned the application part at the very, very front end, these are things that we would consider with that. So also reaching out to the colleges and high schools, things like that, to do just that, to do shadow programs, to do things like internship programs to bring folks in early on to not only go through their resume, but also to get them some of that experience that gets them the points to get you to the top of the list that they don't have today. So yes, thank you for that.
And is there a systematic process to do what you just described?
The long term?
The long term.
There are examples of them that we can use. We haven't quite figured out how exactly we're going to go about doing that, but there's plenty of examples out there that we've already looked at and that we will consider here locally.
I'd be interested to hearing at some later date more about that, because okay. Long term, I think that would be
okay.
Very beneficial.
We'll work with Bobby on that when she's back and see
you.
What kind of program we can put together on that.
Other questions?
Yeah, I would also commend the port and your team for bringing this forward. And I think Commissioner McDonald's point about these surrounding programs and outreaches becomes critical, because I think the port has recognized this deficiency, but everybody else is recognizing it too. And so you're competing, you know, with other departments and other public safety units for this same limited set of candidates. So I think
yes, sir.
The sooner you can begin that engagement and the visibility, the better. And, you know, in some ways, this sounds very much like an adaptation of the Rooney rules, where you say, you know, we're not telling you to hire, but we're going to say that in order for there to be a panel that can be brought to us, it's got to be a diverse panel. And I think that that's a valuable first step. And I think, you know, that's an opportunity that can lift all boats. So I commend you. But would strongly encourage those kind of outreaches for with higher ed, Urban League, others who can begin to sort of put this opportunity in front of folks early in their consideration of what their career pathway might be.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead.
One quick one. Thank you very much. This is a request for a first reading in the public hearing, right?
Yes, sir.
So this proposed language still subject to change depending upon the outcome of that procedural steps that you are taking, potentially.
Right. There'll be a public comment period that we'll do here in a second. I just want to say, Chris, that I'm glad you referenced internship because I believe strongly in the opportunity that's created by exposure to a job. And it's not only for the benefit of that intern, but for the community that they come from, that they see an outreach like that to their children. That's huge. So that's really an important piece of the program. And I think all the questions have been great in terms of our enthusiasm to support this kind of program. So with that, I do, if there are no other questions or comments, I need to have you read the title, Chris, of the ordinance.
An ordinance amending and restating Port Ordinance Number 275 as amended by Port Ordinance Number 300 as amended by Port Ordinance Number 425-R that establishes a civil service system for firefighters and created a civil service commission.
Okay. And now open the public hearing if there are any comments to be made on the proposed ordinance. Seeing no hands or other gestures, I'll close the public hearing. And as was mentioned, there's no action, official action to be taken by the commission at this time, but Ordinance 462-R will be back before the commission for a second reading and request for adoption in November. Okay, thanks, Chris. And that concludes our agenda, so I'll adjourn the meeting. Thanks.